Hello, my name's Kate Rolls and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust as you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's new artwork, One and Other. The date today is the 9th of August 2009 and the time is 1:20 p.m. If I can please ask you to state your full name, your date of birth and where you come from.
My name is Philip Hayden Goodband and I'm from Dorking and I was born on the 26th of May 1944.
And how are you today?
I'm brilliant, thank you.
Good. And you're going to be standing on the fourth plinth shortly. What was it that motivated you to apply to be part of One Another?
Well, first of all, I love Anthony Gormley's work. I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's very creative and modern and makes you think. And so when the opportunity came, it was something that I just felt immediately I wanted to participate in. Because in my role as a master of wine, I've been involved with the wine industry now for 40 years. Actually, this is the 40th anniversary of my joining the wine trade. So I just thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to explore the art of wine, which is the title of my hour, and to describe what a civilizing influence wine has been, the development of wine in the UK over the past 40 years. I mean, there's been some huge changes. And so to describe some of those and to take the opportunity to have a question and answer session with people around the plinth. They can ask me anything they want on the subject of wine and I'll do my best to answer them. And to have a little tasting, which my family, who's here supporting me, 25, I think, are going to be here, are going to run a little tasting at the foot of the plinth.
Wonderful. So that's quite a number of things you're going to do.
Yes.
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 How did you decide to bring your love of wine to this project? How did you decide to make that your focal point?
Well, this is an art project. And it so happens that on my certificate, my master's certificate, it actually says that I was examined in the art of wine. And that's what it says on the certificate. And so I was, the two just seemed to come together and prompted me to use that as my theme.
Okay. And would you like to speak a little bit about your time, your experience in the wine industry? How you became involved initially?
It all happened by accident, like most good things in life. I was wanting a holiday job when I was at school, and some friends of my parents had a couple of wine shops in Camberley, in Surrey, about 30 miles away. And I went and helped them during the school holidays. And then later on, when I became a little bit older, I became more interested. And ultimately, it became clear that to me that I actually wanted to be in the wine industry. It was just such an interesting way of life. The travel, the languages, the meeting people, the getting involved with the creation of something was really something that spoke to me. And so I eventually, much to my parents' horror, actually said, look, I want to go into the wine business, because at that time, wine was not an everyday thing at all. We're talking about in the very late 1960s. Wine was not as ubiquitous as it is now. And it took quite a bit of persuasion. But eventually my father relented and he said, well, okay, providing you study and you get fully qualified, which led, of course, to my Master of Wine. And there are only still less than 300 Masters of Wine in the world. So.
And what training did you undergo to become a Master of Wine?
A very, very rigorous training. In fact, it took about 6 years. It involved working abroad in the vineyards, it involved working in the cellars, actually doing the hard manual work. It involved study, of course, because the exam requires you to write written papers as well as practical tasting exams. And I was very fortunate to be in a company where they supported and helped me with my studies, which, as I say, took around 6 years to do. And that culminated in my actually becoming the youngest ever Master of Wine.
And where did you learn? Through what institution?
Basically, in London. First of all, through what is now the Wine and Spirit Education Trust, which is down near London Bridge. And then, actually, in practical terms, with the winemakers. In those days, there wasn't any kind of formal training. You had to do it all yourself. There was the examination, and there, you had to organise your own tasting groups, you had to study, you had to get all the material together yourself, with very little guidance, in fact, from the institute. And so it was done in a number of different places, both here in the UK and overseas.
And how was it to go overseas and to experience the vineyard's way of making?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, the experience was incredible, because I was actually at places around Europe. I went to Champagne, to Germany, to Alsace, to Italy, where I worked in the Chianti Classico region on an estate. I then went down to Spain and Portugal. And so meeting all these different people, hearing how they make their wines, how they tend their vines in the vineyards, because the vineyard has just as much importance as in the winery, was a wonderful way of learning, because you're able to compare the cultures of different countries and different regions with one another within the space of a few years. And of course, that is really a unique experience.
And the people that were predominantly the makers of wine, did it tend to be family businesses a lot of the time?
Yes, almost all the businesses that I was, as it were, stationed at during that period were family businesses. And in fact, the wine industry is still full of family businesses. There are, of course, the big corporations, but by far and away the majority of winemaking is done at family domains.
And were they quite open to other people coming and learning about their work?
One of the most, I think, rewarding parts of being in the wine industry is that everybody is absolutely open. There are no secrets in the wine industry. You can go anywhere, ask any questions, they will give you honest answers. They will make you welcome. In fact, in many places, I was put up in people's houses. And even today, when, you know, competition is so fierce, you can still do that. You can still go anywhere. And they will welcome anybody from the wine industry. And in fact, many winemakers from one part of the world will now travel to another and do a vintage, as we call it, actually make the wine in somebody else's winery during the harvest. Of course, you've got northern and southern hemispheres now. So during the winter, it's their winter in the southern hemisphere. So people are preparing for the harvest over here. And then next spring, our spring, they will go down to the southern hemisphere and do the harvest there. So all that kind of exchange of information is going on even today.
And what have your experiences been of working in the wine industry? Could you take us through a chronology of that? Within the UK?
Yes. How long have we got? Cut 40 years down to a few minutes. Well, back in the 1960s, there were no supermarkets selling wines and spirits. They weren't licensed. All the wines and spirits were sold through off-licenses. And those off-licenses, just to give you a flavour of what things were like and how things have changed, those off-licenses had shutters at the back of the windows to stop people outside seeing the people inside buying liquor. Compare that with today, where you have supermarkets which all have licenses, you have big off-license and wine shops with plate glass windows, lots of lighting, and everybody wants you to see what's going on inside. So that's a very big change over the 40 years. So the first thing, big change, was that. The second was that in those days, most of the wines that were being drunk were from the what we call the old world, France, Germany, Spain, Portugal, and so on. The new world didn't exist. It wasn't until 1985 when, I mean, I had the good fortune of being the chairman of the Institute of Masters of Wine and led the first official MW visit to Australia, that that visit acted as the catalyst for the drive for Australian wine into the UK. And so from zero sales in 1985, Australia is now the biggest country of supply to the UK. So that's another huge change. If we talk about the style of wine, the styles of wine that were being drunk then were sweet or sweetish, things like Blue Nun, Black Tower, Matthias Rosé, and Yugoslav, the old Yugoslavia, things like Yugoslav Riesling, which was sort of semi-sweet, because we in this country had not got a culture of wine drinking. And so you start normally, when you don't drink wine, drinking sweeter wines. And gradually all that's changed as our tastes have dried, and things such as rosé, for example. Rosé has become very popular recently, but that's only very recent. And it's very interesting that the bulk of rosés being sold today are actually semi-sweet. And they are introducing a new generation of wine drinkers to the joys of wine drinking. Another big thing which changed was in 1981, when, again, I was deeply involved. In fact, I was responsible for launching the very first bag-in-box wines here in the UK, the 3-litre bag-in-box, where the bag contracts around the wine and you can have a glass whenever you want it. That didn't exist. And of course, that because people had to open bottles before 1981, it was a kind of barrier to consumption. People felt that if you opened a bottle, you had to drink it. So after the bag-in-box came along, that really liberalized, it liberated people, allowed people, it gave people permission to have a glass of wine whenever they wanted it. And so the bag-in-box really has had a big role to play in the what I call the democratization of wine drinking here in the UK. And now I think represents something like 10% of the total wine sold here. Mm-hmm. What it also did was to allow pubs to sell fresh wine by the glass, something which didn't exist in the early late 1960s, early 70s, and didn't exist really until the late 80s, because before then, nobody knew how to keep wine fresh. They opened the bottle, it was left half full or half empty, depending which way you look at it. It oxidized, and the next person or three people down the road or the following day would get a nasty oxidized glass of wine. Now that the bag-in-box helped liberalize and make it possible for those pubs to serve wine by the glass. That, combined with the advent of food in the pubs, began, I think, the evolution of wine drinking with food. And of course, today, food and wine is very big business on television, celebrity chefs, and so on. So you can really date that back to 1981, with the introduction of the wine box. What else is there? Well, of course, I've talked about the advent of New World wines. I mean, it may surprise you to know that New Zealand, which sells such delicious Sauvignon Blanc, there wasn't a vine of Sauvignon Blanc in New Zealand until 1973. So the development of that particular source of supply and that particular type of wine from New Zealand has only developed since then, since 1973. Other huge changes in the retailing of wine, and I think one of the most exciting things for the future will be the ability to have tastings of wine in store from these new machines, that where you put a card in and it will serve you a predetermined measure of wine and keep the rest of the wine under inert gas to stop it from oxidizing. So there are developments going on today which I think are very exciting for the future. So we've come a very long way. Don't let's forget that we in this country have been involved in wine since, well, at least since the 12th century, if not before, because the 12th century was when the Worshipful Company of Vintners here in the city, one of the great 12 livery companies of the City of London, was founded. And they were involved, deeply involved, and are still involved heavily in the wine industry. In fact, my certificate as a Master of Wine was issued by the Vintners Company. And they were responsible for setting up the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. They were responsible for the regulation of the wine trade until just a couple of years ago. So, you know, the institutions have been deeply involved in our and in the creation of our heritage. And on the question of heritage, I mean, one particular thing I'd like to mention is that we in this country actually invented the champagne method for making sparkling wine. Back in the late 1600s, a guy called Christopher Merritt is recorded in the archives of the City of London as having invented this method. And the first time that the word champagne was written was in 1676 in an English publication. This afternoon I'm going to quote from that publication up on the plinth. You could say, therefore, that we invented champagne. And that was 30 years before Dom Perignon. Today, sparkling wine is very big business here in the UK. We're making some excellent sparkling wines. Some of them, Nightimber, Ridgeview, Denbys, Camel Valley, are doing extremely well and winning trophies around the world. So I think with global warming, the future is very bright indeed.
And are you still working in the wine industry now?
I am indeed, yes. I'm very active in the wine industry. I'm currently project managing for Constellation, which is a big wine company, a series of modules, training modules for their staff. Because in these times of recession that we're going through, staff are extremely important. The staff that remain, those that haven't been made redundant, are very important to companies. And actually, companies will only succeed if they train their staff. And I feel very strongly, because of the training I received back at the beginning, that this is something that I should be doing for the new generation of wine merchants.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing all of that about the wine industry and such a specific knowledge that you have that not a lot of people will have. So it's great to hear that and be able to share that.
Thank you.
Can I also now ask you a little bit about yourself, if you would be kind enough to tell us something about who you are. I'll let you choose initially what you'd like to say and perhaps ask certain questions. But
of course.
Who's that man on the plinth today?
Well, my name is Philip Goodband. I'm a master of wine. I'm married. I have two children, both of whom are grown up, both with their own children. So I'm a grandfather, proud grandfather of two granddaughters, whose names are Genevieve and Maisie. My family part of my family lives in Surrey, not far from me, my son, his wife and daughter. My other daughter lives down in Essex, not too far away, about an hour's drive away. My wife and I also have a home in California. My wife is Californian, and I do quite a lot of my work over there, as well as here in the UK and France. I play tennis twice a week. I'm very active, and I enjoy going to galleries, art events. I'm fantastically thrilled to be here today on participating in this Anthony Gormley project on the plinth. What else can I tell you?
How did you meet your Californian wife?
It was a series of well, if I call it fate, I actually believe that it was fate. I was over there with a group of salespeople from the UK doing a mentoring tutorial tour of the wineries of Northern California, And on a particular day, at a particular time, we were overnighting at a hotel in a town called Lodi, which is east of San Francisco, in the middle of the vineyards. And I had about a dozen or so of these guys and girls with me. And towards the end of dinner, we were out on the terrace. It was a beautiful evening in September. Some guys started chatting to three girls at a table that was somewhere over there, and I hadn't even noticed them. And then later, one of my colleagues came up to me and said, "Philip, come with me. I've got somebody I'd like you to meet." And I was taken down to the other end table and introduced to Anne-Marie, and I have to say that was that. So fortunately, I was over there for another one of these tours a month later. We met, got on very well. And then we didn't meet for some time. I mean, it was, you know, I was in England and she was in California. But what then happened was unbelievable, because somebody, my boss, who had no idea about any of this, said to me one day, "Philip, I've got a job I'd like you to do. Would you be willing to go to California and make a new wine range for us?" And I said, "Yes, I would. Where would that be?" Because it's a very big place, California. You could be in lots of different places. And believe it or not, it was in Lodi. So there I was, back making wine with my colleagues in Lodi, literally 20 minutes from where Anne-Marie lived. And so that gave us the opportunity to get to know each other. And eventually we got married.
Wonderful. And where did you get married?
We were married at the hotel at which we met, in their garden, in the wedding garden there, which was glorious. It was 6 o'clock in the evening on the 4th of October, and it was just great.
And how long did you live in California for?
Well, I've been, we have a home there, as I say, so we to and fro. And in fact, the week after next, we will be going over to California, and we'll be spending I'll be spending a month there, and she'll be spending about 6 weeks because she takes the chance to see her family and so on. Mm-hmm. So we at that time, back when I was making the wine, I was there for about 18 months. So, you know, it's sort of home from home.
Mm-hmm. And what does Anne-Marie do for a living?
Well, before she married me, she was a real estate broker, a licensed real estate broker. And that's rather difficult when I'm being called to do work all around the globe, to be doing that. So she's actually resting at the moment, but our plans are that I will do more work in California, and then she wants to go back and do some more real estate broking.
Lovely. And would you like to say a little bit about your two children?
Yes, my two wonderful children. Emily is the elder. She's the one who lives down in Essex. She actually works in the charity field, and I'm very proud of her for doing that. She runs a resource centre down in Southend, and does wonderful work for all the needy people down there, people who are partially sighted and blind, and it's a great job. And she's my granddaughter is at West Cliff High School for Girls. She's just 11 now, 12, she's 12. And my son Henry lives in Leatherhead, which is close to Dorking, near where I live. He runs a testing laboratory for a company called Pyra, which tests all sorts of the packages that things of you and I buy in the shops, in the supermarkets, before they actually appear on sales, the new packs. And he gets to work all over the world with that. He's been on trips to Scandinavia, to Egypt, to Brazil, seeing how these new packs travel around the world and what happens to them, mm-hmm. and the kind of problems that they might encounter. So he's there, and my daughter-in-law, Madeline, works for the RSB. She works for a part of the bank, which is very fashionable at the moment, lending money to people. So, and of course, they both look after Maisie, who's just one. She's just one. So she's walking, and she's a real poppet.
Lovely. And what's important now for you moving forwards with your life? What's important to you?
I think for the foreseeable future, as I mentioned, this whole area of training and giving something, giving my experience, giving the benefit of what knowledge I have to the new generation of people in the wine industry. It's every bit as interesting now as it was when I started 40 years ago. And I think that anybody wanting to make a career in the wine industry would have, providing they have the enthusiasm, the drive, the interest, would find it a great place to be. So that's my prime, as it were, aim over the next few years. Apart from, of course, continuing to work and create new wines that you will find and you can buy on shelf in the stores here in the UK.
Can I ask a little bit about your family history as well? What do you know about that?
My family history. Well, I know a lot more about my mother's side of the family than I do about my father's. So we start with my father because it's not that much. I know that that my father and his parents, my grandparents, came from the Midlands, from Nottingham. And my grandfather was, in fact, headmaster of the school in Melbourne, Derbyshire, which gave its name to Melbourne, Australia, by the way. And then they moved down here, and he was headmaster of a school in Crowthorne, in Berkshire. My father was an only child. Going back beyond them, I know that there are quite a lot of good bands, and it's an unusual name. Quite a lot of good bands in Nottingham and districts still. So one of these days I may well get round to seeing if I can track a few of my relatives up there down. On my mother's side, I actually have a good record because my mother kept a lot of the old letters and photographs. And in fact, I have old photographs on glass of my great-great-grandparents. And so I have a family tree which goes back quite a long way. And I'm in touch with quite a few of the branches of the family. Her family were in Yateley, which is quite close to Camberley, which is, I suppose, how my father and mother came to meet. It was, of course, just before the Second World War. And then my father was away, and I didn't see my father for 4 years because he was away at the war. Luckily, he came back. My mother, on the other hand, she was always busy. She was a member of quite a large family. She had five sisters and a brother, and there's just one sister, one of my aunts remaining. One of my cousins, was a double Olympic champion at three position rifle shooting. His name was Malcolm Cooper, and we were all very proud of him when he did that, because he was many times world champion as well as Olympic champion. Other than that, I don't think we've got anybody who's really famous in our family. We're from very, very modest background, and I was the first member of the family to go into the wine industry, which was why my father was so horrified. I think that's probably all I can tell you off the top of my head about the family, without getting into sort of rather boring details about individuals.
Okay, lovely, thank you. And finally, what does it mean to you personally to stand on the fourth plinth of Trafalgar Square today?
Well, I think the first emotion is one of pride. I mean, I just think to have the opportunity to stand on the fourth plinth, which was originally, as I understand it, destined for an equestrian statue of some description, and to be able to survey the scene in Trafalgar Square, and to talk to people about my first love, which is wine, is just an incredible opportunity. And so that's what it really means for me. I'm so proud, so thrilled, and actually so honoured to be able to do it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Philip. Thank you.
Pleasure.